that gift for that wonderful phrase.
Joining me now is Patricia T. O'Connor, author of three little books on the use of the English language, Woe Is I, Words Fail Me, and then the one about emails, since that requires a whole different take on the language. That one is You Send Me, written with her husband. And when she's here, we take your calls at 212-433-9692. I gather you were inspired today to talk a bit about something that's happening at the city council, perhaps right now.
I think so. The city council is expected today to pass a symbolic resolution intended to discourage the casual use of the racial slur, the N-word, which I'd rather not say. I hope none of us will. But
heard a lot on the subway these days by
a lot,
kids speaking quite casually.
On the street and whatnot. And this word, although it's probably the most inflammatory racial slur in English, and it's possibly the most offensive and hurtful to a great many people, has become a slang greeting among black teenagers in recent years, and is you can hear it quite casually almost anywhere. And while the city council is expected to pass this resolution, it doesn't have the force of law, it's symbolic only, there's by no means a unanimity among even blacks that that it's a good idea to censor a word like this, although most of us would be perfectly happy never hearing it again.
Because some people feel that by reclaiming it and using it in the way that it's often used, you take the negative out of it.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen this with some other words. In fact, the word black initially was a way of reclaiming a word that had gone into disrepute.
Right.
Colored was nicer, and Negro was the respectable word. Now nobody says Negro.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that we've also seen in the gay community, where we now hear of queer studies. But certain words that you might hear amongst gays, you can't hear from straight people toward gays, as
exactly.
We saw recently in a big to-do about somebody on a TV set using a word that we hear gay men use quite casually.
There's a Stanford linguist who's done some work on this issue, and this whole process is called a semantic inversion. And this is what happens when a victimized group seizes a derogatory term that's painful to that group and reclaims it as their own, and it gives them a kind of empowerment. They've taken back that vocabulary, and it empowers them. It not only tends to nullify the hurt of the word, but it gives them that much more control.
But we haven't seen this with other groups where there have been nasty words. And perhaps because with African Americans and with gays, there's still a feeling that they're much more discriminated against than the Jews or the Irish or Hispanics, who all had really awful words in common use when I was a kid.
Right. And another thing that's sort of lent momentum to all this is that beginning about in the 70s with comedians like Richard Pryor and Dick Gregory, and actually Leonard Bruce had a routine in which he used the word.
He said if you use it enough, it loses its power. But
yeah, exactly.
I never felt that he was right about that one.
Yeah, and as you know, he went to court over that one, and the judge, who happened to be Thurgood Marshall, didn't agree with him either. But I think that in theory, semantic inversion probably works. It's worked with queer, and I think it works. Women call each other. I won't get into them.
But they call each other girls.
Yeah, yeah. And I think though that with the N word, it's in a class by itself. Actually, it's not a recent word. You will hear people argue that the N-word that everyone objects to is merely a Southern American pronunciation of the word Negro. But that's actually not true. The two words, Negro and the other, both occurred at about the same time in the 16th century. Negro goes back to 1548, not the same spelling, different spellings, but that pronunciation. And at the same time, the N-word first appeared in 1587, spelled N-E-E-G-E-R, and then there were various spellings after that until it finally arrived at the spelling that we know today in 1786.
But wouldn't it come from the same root?
Exactly. They both come from the same root, the Latin word for black, which inherently has nothing negative about it. Although it has to be said that both of these words came about, were first used in relation to the slave trade, and they were used to refer to people who were cargo, who were livestock. So it definitely was derogatory. Both words were derogatory even back then. Over the centuries, Negro became fairly respectable, and at one time, even the N-word we know today used to appear regularly in literature and song lyrics. I remember a favorite author of mine is Angela Thirkell, a British novelist of the 20s, 30s, 40s, and I really love her work. And I once was reading along, and someone was very good at playing a jazz piano, and another character says, "Wow, you play jazz just like an N." Mm-hmm. And it was very jarring. I guess it's just as jarring as it is to me to hear kids use it on the subway.
There are people who use it as a way of describing any kind of discriminated against person, like mm-hmm. women are the ends of the world, or gun owners, I've heard, are the ends of American
yes.
society.
Yes.
Yeah. You want to talk about any kind of put upon people. There are people who, I remember years ago having Paul Mooney, the black comedian, on the show, and he used the word all the time and defended it. And now mm-hmm. he's reversed himself on
uh-huh.
it.
Yeah. I think that that's happened with some rap musicians who have reversed themselves and decided that it's not such a good idea to throw that word around loosely. I don't know how Tupac Shakur would feel if he were still with us, but he and the early hip-hop folks in the late 80s and early 90s, as you know, threw it around pretty loosely. And I think now there's a division in the among hip-hop people about whether that's such a great idea. On the one hand, it is empowering, and maybe it will take the sting out of a terrible word. On the other hand, it's still very painful to a lot of people.
Painful to the point where in Washington, where someone used a perfectly legitimate word, niggardly, at a city council meeting,
mm-hmm.
That led to charges of racism, even though it comes from a totally different root.
Mm-hmm.
It's, I think, a Scandinavian word?
Right. Old English through Scandinavian, meaning cheap or stingy. There are other related words, niggling, which comes from the same root, and they aren't related at all. On the other hand, I think it's too bad what happened to that official, because he meant no harm, and he was merely using a word that anyone could look up in the dictionary and see what its true usage was. At the same time, if I knew that there were people who were going to be hurt by my using a word like niggardly or niggling, I wouldn't do it. I'm not saying that those words should be censored. Certainly don't think that the N-word should be expunged from the dictionaries, as some of the people who are in the movement to abolish the N-word, so to speak, they actually want it removed from dictionaries, which that's going way too far.
What about Huckleberry Finn.
Exactly. The literature is full of those references, and they weren't always meant contemptuously.
Well, I'm going to propose to the City Council we outlaw the word articulate. My guest is Patricia T. O'Connor, author of Woe Is I, Words Fail Me, You Send Me. And we take your calls at 212-433-9692. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Should we take some calls?
Yeah.
Okay. We will go first to, what is it? Jeff from Manhattan. Hi, Jeff. You're on the air.
Hi. I've got a question. It doesn't really relate to the subject you've just been discussing.
Oh, we're talking
that's
about
all right.
Anything grammatical.
I suspected that might be the case, and this is definitely grammatical. I see advertisements sometimes, and they frequently use language in ways that get me thinking. The phrase he's got, H-E apostrophe S, got, G-O-T, how does that differ from he has?
Oh, I'm going to disappoint you here. He's, H-E apostrophe S, is a contraction that can stand for either he is or he has.
Right. So he has got a car versus he has a car.
That's another issue. He's got a car. I don't object to the word got used in that way. And I think that you'll find in the last, 20 years or so, that most grammarians and usage people don't find that bothersome. It's become so common colloquially that it's now moved into standard English.
We have other ones like, where's the bus stop at?
Well, where is it at? That's, I think that's another matter.
Somehow that one seems
to go a little bit overboard.
That's going too far for you.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you for calling us, Jeff. Margaret from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air. Margaret, you have to turn off your radio because you're going to be very confused. There's a slight delay.
Oh, hi. Thank you so much for the opportunity to ask these questions. I had two things that bother me, maybe old fogyism, but one is a radio ad for the New York Times, articles that feel like they were written just for you. And the other is the use of very current ads on WQXR for some play, I think a historic play, about a queen who encounters a queen more powerful than her.
Mm.
And this is another.
But wait, what's wrong with the first one?
Oh, it was the like,
that
I think.
Feel like they were written.
Oh, feel as they were written?
Yeah, I think, Margaret, that's a lost cause.
Yeah.
That use of like has also moved into standard English.
Okay.
Whether you like it or not.
Right.
Okay, that's my old fogyism. But
right.
This than her really bothers mm-hmm. me grammatically. How do you feel about that?
Well, I would avoid it myself, but I wouldn't necessarily censor other people for doing it because there's a pretty reasonable case to be made for the use of than in that case as a preposition. Once in a while, William Sapphire will bring this up in his column that there's really not that good a reason for considering than to be a conjunction that should be followed by the nominative case, as in than she, than I. It does act as a preposition, and it seems to be more normal American speech. So I guess I've let you down.
Well, than she sometimes sounds pretentious,
mm-hmm.
where even though it is the correct word, and that
right.
is a problem. Sometimes we just want to sound natural.
Exactly. And there's a difference, I think, between written speech and a written language and spoken language. I'd be a little more careful if I were writing an article to say than she or than he or than I. I don't have any hesitation saying then me normally.
Thank you so much for your call, Margaret. Robert from Long Island, you're on the air.
Hi, Leonard. I have a question for you. I am a physician in a pediatric emergency department, and we teach residents all the time. And the residents often present a case and tell me that the child is nauseous. Mm. And I correct that by saying that I think the word is nauseated, because I was taught that nauseous means that it would make me, the doctor, feel ill to my stomach.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
Yeah, the classic, the traditional difference between nauseous and nauseated is that nauseous means sick-making, and nauseated is made sick. So
right.
So you're right. But almost no one recognizes that distinction anymore.
No,
in fact,
okay.
I took it out of the second edition of my book, What Was I? I think. I intended to, because it's just one of those distinctions that's not, you're wasting your breath to object to it. Once people start using it consistently in a different way and dictionaries take it up,
mm-hmm.
You may as well give up. There are other things you can focus on,
okay.
Like impact as a verb.
Thank you so much for your call. We go now to Jonathan from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Great show. I guess advertisers have a lot to answer for these days, it seems. My particular bugaboo in this case is the use of every day as one word. I don't know if you've noticed the proliferation of that usage when they really mean every day as two words.
Mm.
And it's sort of funny because, for example, Toyota, I think that's their slogan, every day. And it means ordinary, commonplace,
right.
Mundane.
It's
yeah.
an everyday occurrence is mm-hmm. the one word, but every day I have the blues is two separate words.
Right.
Exactly. And that's, I think, Dasani has a similar tagline. And you think with the millions they're spending on, you know, these ad campaigns and that they're basically one word or two words that they'd get it right. But I think a certain irony in the fact that they're sort of undercutting their whole thrust.
Oh, exactly, because every day the single word means, as you said, ordinary.
Right.
You want an ordinary car? This is the one for you.
Well, exactly. But I see it everywhere now. I mean, that's one word everywhere. But it banks and stuff. I mean, it seems to have become this sort of accepted shorthand that somehow it's interchangeable, and because they can economize on the space between the words or something,
mm-hmm.
that's somehow okay or more zippy or something.
Well, it's perfectly good term. It's not wrong by any means, but it does have a specific meaning.
But what about compound words? We've changed mm-hmm. in the way we have dealt with them in the past.
Right.
Hyphenated. I remember reading a novel by Faulkner, and obviously the copy editor was afraid to challenge him on anything because the first half of the book had all these words with hyphens, and then
mm-hmm.
the second half they were just put together as single words.
Oh, really? That's interesting. Huh.
And I'm sure it was just allowed as a stylistic mm-hmm. quirk mm-hmm. of Faulkner, but I understood why he was putting those words together. And we do a lot mm-hmm. of hyphenated words, mm-hmm. and there are words that when you read old texts where you see hyphens today,
sure.
they are now just one word.
Mm-hmm. Like far-fetched used to be pretty much always hyphenated, and now it's considered to be one word. Things like tight-fisted, second-hand, first-hand, feet first, head first,
mm-hmm.
We've made them into one word.
So maybe that's happening here, although we would lose a distinction in the case of
we
every
would,
day.
Right, and the same with altogether and altogether. And there are some other ones, too.
Okay,
everyone
Jonathan.
Everyone and everyone.
Thank you so much for your call.
Thank you.
We have to take a little break. We'll be back with more of your calls to Patricia T. O'Connor. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. Stay with us.
Oh, baby, what I'd give to hear those three little words. Man, that's such a wonderful phrase.
Thank you.
We're back to Patricia T. O'Connor, author of Woe Is I, Words Fail Me, and You Send Me, and a regular visitor to this show, and somebody who also gets more calls than we can handle. And that's why we often direct people to your website.
Mm-hmm. Right. I'd be happy to take mail. I can't promise I'll get back to you immediately, but I do try to answer everybody eventually.
And it's really interesting to look at some of the mail. Unfortunately, they send it to me, and then I have to forward it to you, which means extra work for me. They can get to you directly by going to Grammarphobia. Well, mailbox at Grammarphobia, one word, Grammarphobia, not hyphenated or anything, .com. And they often have really interesting things to say. Sometimes mm-hmm. they know an awful lot about mm-hmm. derivation of words. Sometimes
right.
they're correct. Sometimes they're wrong. Mm-hmm. But that's also interesting.
It is.
And I'm assuming that this is going into your next book.
Well, it's going into my blog anyway. A lot of the questions that are sent in, my husband Stuart edits them and chooses them, puts one a day on the blog. So check it out. You might see your question on there. But I interestingly got two this past week about something that comes up every once in a while. The word monies, you hear it a lot by bureaucrats, M-O-N-I-E-S, monies.
Mm-hmm.
And a woman says, my husband and I hate this word monies. We refuse to use it. I'm 44 and he's 47. I guess we're old school. And then a listener named Mark in Paris also wrote in about monies. And he says, the French, as you may know, have a love-hate relationship with money. They have it, but they hate to talk about it. But their term is crédit. That's their bureaucratie for money. And labor unions in France don't speak about money. They prefer to speak of pouvoir d'achat, purchasing power, and moyen, means. So I guess bureaucrats all have their ways of talking about money without making it sound like money.
Well, it depends on whether you're in the moneyed class or not, don't
I
you
suppose
think?
So. But it makes it sound like it's just a bunch of numbers being moved from one column to another with no reality.
But there is a difference between money and monies in some cases, isn't there?
Well, if you...
I know, I've been in that situation.
Currencies?
Well, I've thought about all the different kinds of things that have come in, unless we're just thinking of it all as one large lump of stuff.
I suppose so, but, you know, a normal person doesn't speak of monies. Like, I guess I'll transfer some monies into my checking
no.
account. Or I didn't bring enough monies with me for lunch.
I've thought that a few times.
It's only, it's a quasi-governmental kind of thing or corporate thing.
I guess they're saying we're allocating this money to this, this money to that, this money to this other thing, and together all these monies will then add up to
but
some other
figure.
But why
not together all this money?
I guess I so. Know. I guess it comes down to the same
maybe
thing.
Maybe I'm just being sensitive.
Mices. We go now to Alex from Jersey City. Hi, you're on the air. Alex, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Just wanted to say I love listening to your show. Listen to it all the time. I wanted to comment on what Patricia was saying before about the N-word. I lived in Germany for many years. I speak German very fluently. And when I first moved to Germany in like the mid-90s, the proper word to say someone who was black was, and I'll say it in German, not in English, was Neger. And
wasn't Schwarz or some word that would have to do with the word black?
I mean, there were different variants, but I remember my roommate in Bavaria saying she had this sort of poster of multiculturalism on her door, and it was black children and white children playing together. And she was saying, you know, one of these days I'd love to have a Nega baby.
Hmm.
And that was completely normal. And it's interesting... I traveled to Germany. My wife is from Austria, and so we go to Austria as well. And it's fascinating to see that you can't say that word anymore. Now it's politically much more correct to say Schwarzer or Farbiger, a person of color, like that's the way you would say it. So it's interesting how that this word, although it within the German language, you know, it doesn't connotate, maybe it doesn't have like the same political or historical weight to it, has been sort of phased out because of American political correctness.
That is interesting. It reminds me that there's an Agatha Christie play that you may have heard of. When it came to the United States, it was called Ten Little Indians. Well, it wasn't Ten Little Indians before it came to the United States. It was Ten Little N-Words.
Really?
Right. And then after a while, the term Indians became, not so acceptable, and the play was renamed again to And Then There Were None.
We didn't want to go Ten Little Native Americans.
No.
Thank you for your call.
You're very welcome.
Jane from New York City. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Okay. In 1619, our first sort of use of hired labor, who were black, James Rolfe wrote that a Dutch man of war sold us 20 N-E-G-A-R-S.
Right.
How does that fit in with your etymology of the N-word?
Well, actually, that pronunciation of the word first showed up in 1587, so even quite a long time before Rolfe. It's been spelled any number of ways, but the pronunciation is the same. The first time it appears, it was spelled N-E-E-G-E-R, then N-E-A-G-E-R, then N-E-G-A-R, N-E-G-E-R, N-I-G-O-R. You know, people didn't have dictionaries back in those days, or they didn't consult them.
You probably know Ben Jonson's quote, right?
No, I don't.
It's a poor man who can only spell a word one way.
Oh.
Of course, that was a time when English was still going through all sorts of changes, and the spellings of words had not been finally settled upon. But but now I think it's with spell check, I think it's okay to agree to one spelling, don't you?
Right.
Yes.
But the spelling that we know now,
the Bill Gates spelling.
The spelling we have, most recent spelling, didn't really come along until 1786. It was in a poem by Robert Burns. And I suppose because it was in such a famous piece of published work, that's how it stabilized. That's how the spelling stabilized. But it actually began in 1587, not too long after the word Negro came into English, originally spelled N-Y-G-R-O.
Thank you so much for your call. Steve from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. One point about you were mentioning monies before, and I know that Bloomberg likes to pluralize a lot of things. You'll notice he'll say things like, we have to find a ways of doing such and such.
Uh-huh. Well, that is a New Yorkism, isn't it?
To do so.
And people, he says anyways.
Anyways, another one, right. Okay, on to the subject.
Wait, before you go on, Pat, that's not an uncommon mistake.
No.
But do you know, is that just something that happens in this area?
I don't think so. I grew up in Iowa, and people would say something was a long ways away. So ways was quite commonly pluralized.
Okay. Well, Michael Bloomberg sure has a lot of monies, so he can say whatever
when
he wants.
When you have that much, I guess you have to pluralize it.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
About the N-word discussion, I seem to remember that the term Yankee Doodle Dandy was a derisive term that British troops used for the colonists, and that and then obviously they co-opted it and made it their own and made a song out of it. So that's the history. You mentioned this before, the history of a put-upon group taking a term and making it their own. It goes back a long, long ways, and really, really goes beyond race, too.
And it goes back a long, long ways, you said. Thank you for calling us. Caught you. Jim from Brooklyn, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm just calling to complain about something that I've heard in regular everyday speech that is undoubtedly from bureaucraties, which is to change other, to make verbs out of other parts of speech.
Mm.
Things like impact or dialogue are not verbs, but you hear them used as verbs all the time.
Right.
And there are also a lot of neologisms that are created in bureaucraties that just, they're like fingernails on a blackboard when I hear them in normal speech, like proactive.
I think I mentioned once on the air that I saw an ad for a sports bra that was called the Proactive Sports Bra. Anyway, no, you're right, and I hate that kind of thing. I hate dialogue as a verb. I hate impact as a verb. But to be fair, I have to say that one of the strengths of English is that we do have a fluidity between the parts of speech, that we can adapt them for different uses, and that's probably a strength, even though some really annoying usages come out of it. So what I always tell people is, if you don't like a usage, don't use it, and maybe it will fall out of use.
Thank you so much for your call. By the way, we got some wonderful emails on the N-word, and I would like to read three of them as quickly as I can get through them. This person writes, I taught in the New York City high schools for a number of years. I was the magazine and newspaper advisor. My students insisted in several articles that there was a difference between the N-word as we're using it and the use of it with an A at the end.
Uh-huh.
Also, the usage was so unconscious that I would hear phrases like that Chinese N or even that white N.
Oh, that's interesting.
So it had come to mean just that guy, that kid,
guy,
or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
That by the way, doesn't sell the word to me, but I understand what he's saying. This person says, I'm a preschool teacher, and I just want to share a short anecdote that came up in a staff meeting. A 4-year-old white student became extremely upset when a 3-year-old black student, who was a good friend of his, called him the N-word as they were playing together. When the classroom teacher entered the fray to help them unravel the problem, she discovered that the 3-year-old had meant to be letting his older brother know, using the familiar language of his home, that he was a good friend, similar to calling him brother. Obviously, the 4-year-old had already been taught in his home that this was an unthinkable insult never to be uttered. I wonder what the impact of a council decree on the use of a word that has grown to have such different meanings in different families would really mean to those families who have embraced the word to the point of imparting a positive sense of it to their young children. Might this turn out to be yet another instance of official disempowerment of the very community which this decision is intended to protect?
Very interesting comment.
Now, of course, it's non-binding in the same way that any resolution against the war in Iraq is non-binding. But symbolism is important. And this listener writes, takes another position. She says, older generations on the subway cringe and feel the pain of the past within that word and the sorrow that the youngsters are at ease with it being disconnected from the past. I, as a black woman who has lived through all formulations of the N and B words, have never felt comfortable with any word that society has formulated to identify me by my race. Having grown up in Texas, I found N like a slap across the face and still do, no matter who says it. I found Negro distancing and black just an empty word to burst the bubble of the mainstream who found its use as derogatory. African, well, if I could discover my family's real roots, I might identify more comfortably. My people are not hyphenated Americans because we do not come to this country for freedom, or did not come to this country for freedom as every other group did. We came here to be enslaved. We have earned the designation American since we helped build the country by enforced unpaid labor. And I think that this conversation will continue. I want to thank all of you who have written in and have called. And Pat, once again, they can contact you at mailbox@gramophobia.com. We will see you on March 21st.
See you
then. And I really look forward to that. It's been a lot of fun today.
Thank you.
A
On tomorrow's underreported segment, we talk about violence against young girls in Zimbabwe and also in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And then a husband and wife medical team talk about their work helping to rebuild Afghanistan's healthcare system, plus two skaters from New York City's only all-female roller derby league, and a man who spent 20 years on death row before DNA evidence exonerated him. The Leonard Lopez Show is produced by Sarah English, Brenna Farrell, and Blake Neshek. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Sarah Rivka Davidson, Stephen Valentino, and contributing producer Virginia Doris. Jason Isaac was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopez, your host. I'll see you tomorrow.